Maggie O, hey, how are you doing? It's nice to see you.
Good to see you too. Yeah, we're still in this kind of post-pandemic shutdown world. So we're on Zoom. So great to see you virtually.
Yeah, are you working from home, or are you working in a studio space now, or?
So Google is doing kind of hybrid. So we're doing return to office for a few days and work from home for other days. So I get to work out of the San Francisco Google office. And we were working from home for, you know, the pandemic. So
what do you do? Remotely. Can you tell me what you do at Google?
Yeah. So right now I'm a senior technical program manager for machine learning and computer vision on Project Starline.
Oh, so you work with Dan Goldman?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, cool. No way. That's awesome. Yeah. I talked to him a while back, and I watched the whatever it was, the Google I/O video, I think, where they sort of showed it. So cool. Really Thanks. Neat stuff. Totally wild. Well, so we were trying to figure out just a second ago if we've met each other before. Now, just real quick, what years were you at ILM?
So I was actually at ILM twice. So 2003 to 2008. Okay. And then again on the Lucasfilm side from 2016 to 2018.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if we ever have met, unless we met maybe at a party or something, because I was there. I left in 90. I was there from 92 to 99.
So we just missed each other.
Yeah. Well, so seeing as how then we don't really know each other, I got to ask, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
So I was born and raised in Chicago, pretty much like the center of Chicago. So not a suburb. So I went to elementary school and high school in Chicago.
That's cool. So growing up in Chicago as a kid, were you like a science kid, or were you into like math or art or?
So art on my own. So, you know, read a lot of comic books, watched a lot of animated films. So when I was growing up, it was like everything from Voltron and the original Transformers to the Transformers movie to all the way to Batman the Animated Series. And I got totally hooked on Batman the Animated Series. I was like, I really, really, really want to work in animation. And I applied to a whole bunch of art schools for undergrad. And
you knew you were like, you were totally, that was your jam. You knew it.
Yeah. I loved all the animation. It's like, this could be better. And I remember watching Toy Story and all the Pixar shorts. I'm like, I want to work there.
Did you as a kid, did you do like little computer animations as a kid, or flip books or things like that? Or did you draw a lot?
I drew a lot. Did maybe like some flip books, but not, that wasn't my main focus. I did more like illustration and mixed media and drawing in high school because I was like, I'm going to work in comic books. I'm going to work in animation. And this is how to get into the door.
That's cool. So you really had a sense of, as a young person, like of a job. You're like, this is something I want to do for a living.
Yeah, totally. My mom was like, well, you're pretty good at science. You're pretty good at math. So for your undergrad degree, how about like engineering or, you know, pre-med or something? And then after that, you can do whatever you want. It's like, okay.
So where did you go for your undergrad?
So for undergrad, I went to MIT. In Cambridge, Massachusetts for computer science and electrical engineering. So I actually started off as a chem E major because there wasn't a pre-med major at MIT back then. I was trying to kind of formulate my own curriculum to fulfill all the pre-med parts. And then I was like, I don't know if I want to do that one course in chemical engineering. So I switched to computer science and electrical engineering. Like halfway through my junior year. So
Did they have any classes in that program? Were there any courses that dealt with image processing at all?
So for computer science, yes, you can take a course called, well, back then it was called 6837, which was the intro to computer graphics class. It was a joint class between the undergrads and grads, so you couldn't take it as an undergrad until it was like an elective or like one of the last classes that you took. Pretty much everything else in the curriculum for course 6-2, which is what I was, is like algorithms, math, circuits,
right?
Hardware, breadboards and stuff. And I was like, I really, really, really want to get into computer graphics. So I did everything that I could to take that class as one of my last classes in undergrad.
Yeah. And did it like, were a lot of the, I would imagine like a lot of the other courses that you were taking though, like that foundation and having that background really would make the course in graphics, like in a strange way, kind of potentially easier? No?
Well, I mean, I think the graphics class was, as like most MIT classes, are theoretical in practice, as opposed to pragmatic and practical. Like they're not really production ready.
Right.
So it's more of like, okay, here's all the math and theory and approaches to solving the problem. But if you solve the problem correctly, it's just a little bonus as opposed to figuring out how to get to the solution space overall. And so probably one of the more helpful classes that I took before taking graphics was a signal processing class where it wasn't specifically about image processing, but it was all about like the Fourier transforms and how to do convolutions and, you know, why is fast Fourier transforms better, you know, Z-space plotting. It was like meant for circuits. And it's like, well, cool, but image manipulation and audio manipulation is all about signal processing. So, I distinctly remember asking my teaching assistant who was helping me out with a problem set during that semester. I was like, okay, so there's this new DJ equipment called the Pioneer CDJ 100s. And there's this feature called master tempo. How does it do it? Like, is it doing all of the math in software? Is it doing all of the convolutions and transforms in hardware? How does that even work? So, he walked me through it and that was like one of the more eye-opening conversations that I had. It was like, oh, this makes total sense. Like math is the foundation. So I can apply it to audio. I can apply it to images. And
were you into music as a kid too? Did you play an instrument or anything?
Yeah. So my first instrument was piano. My second one was violin. And then I did handbells. Yeah. And I did handbells for a while. And then I picked up guitar in college and then I started composing, like towards the end of high school and throughout college.
Did you do stuff like, it's interesting you bring up the signal processing just because I had a conversation with, Josh Pines, who used to be the head of scanning at the old ILM and he went to Cooper Union and he talked a lot about, kind of getting his pathway was through an interest in electronic music and into sort of an understanding of computer science. And was that, that connective tissue, did that drive, for you, like propel you further in? Did you ever consider a career doing stuff in music or was it always geared towards animation?
So I would say that yes, music has always been kind of like that. Ooh, wouldn't that be awesome? But also, wow, I'm getting so old that maybe now is not the time to start a new career. I still make mixes and DJ for for parties and stuff like that. Had a radio show for like four and a half years.
Really? Wait, at the university?
Yeah. So at MIT, there's a radio station called WMBR 88.1. And it's located in, get this, Walker Memorial Basement Radio. So that's why we call it WMBR.
It's perfect.
And for a long time, I had the only electronic music show. And I actually named my show Electronic Music Studio after the studio class that I took in high school. It's kind of like an homage. So.
Oh, that's cool. That's so awesome. Wow. So you, at the end of your time at MIT, it's a BS degree. Is that right?
Bachelor of Science. Yep.
Yeah. So what do you do post-graduation? Do you have like, or did you do any like, I don't know if MIT, do they do like co-ops or internship type programs?
Yeah. So I did do a UROP, which is the undergrad research opportunity program. And I worked through MIT Media Lab for several summers. And actually that's how I got to go to SIGGRAPH. My first ever SIGGRAPH was helping out the Believable Characters AI group doing Alpha Wolf demos. So that was, wow, a long
time
ago.
Where was that? Was it in LA that year?
It was in LA that year, yeah.
Had you, growing up in the Midwest and going to university in Massachusetts, had you been out to California before?
For visits and stuff, but not like for a really long, you know, contiguous amount of time. I actually got accepted into an MD PhD program at USC. And the reason why I turned that down was because at that point I had not been to California before. So it's like, do they have snow? Are there seasons? Like, what's the food like out there?
So yeah, those are all such good questions. Yeah. And there's so many answers to all of them.
Yep.
That's cool. So, all right. So you go to that first SIGGRAPH and in LA and like and you're sort of helping out as part of this class, a co-op type class. Are you like, do you get a chance to go and attend a bunch of sessions kind of on your own? And
let's see, since I was helping out kind of like a demo booth station in the electronic the emerging technology section.
Okay.
I went to, if I can remember back that far, pretty sure I went to the electronic theater.
Well, just, I mean, only in terms of like, you know, one of the things, at least for me, I thought about like my first SIGGRAPH was, it was very illuminating. Like I saw so many things that like really expanded my mind about like what the field of computer graphics could entail. And so I think I'm always sort of curious people's first SIGGRAPH experience, like if they feel like, you know, does it sort of change their trajectory in any way or open up any new pathways?
Let's see. So back then, I think I was too young to really understand how big SIGGRAPH was, right? Like it was, okay, it's a conference. We're presenting, you know, a demo at a conference. Great. And it was more about like being able to go to LA and hang out and network. Cause at that time I was just ending my undergrad. I was still working in the Boston area in the .com industry. it was more like, wow, there are a lot of people here. And just talking to people who are coming by the demo station were, you know, that was fascinating. It was more of the people connection versus like going to a particular session that was like, oh, this is technology that's mind blowing. I think at that point I was just still too early in my career to be like, that is groundbreaking. You know, I just had I had no calibration set to say like, oh, that's cool or that is monumental.
Well, I think that's actually, you know, what you talk about, like probably the most significant piece of SIGGRAPH is that networking piece, meeting people, mm-hmm. hearing about what people do, like, you know, getting people's, you know, business cards or having a drink with them or going to a party or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that's so profound. And I actually think that's the one thing since the onset of the pandemic, that's one thing, not just with SIGGRAPH, but just in general in the workplace too, like the mm-hmm. loss of that, like, there are benefits to like working from home and not having to commute and all that kind of stuff. But I think there's a lot of things that are lost too when we don't have that sort of human face-to-face engagement, you know?
It's one thing. Totally.
I totally miss.
And just like walking around the halls of SIGGRAPH right now, it's just an opportunity to run into people that you haven't seen in so long. It's like, I recognize that person.
How do we know each other?
Yeah, I should just go say hi. And that kind of opportunistic meeting is what I've really missed about, you know, in-person conference attendance. Really looking forward to SIGGRAPH this year and kind of hanging out with people and hearing their, you know, tech papers and sessions
totally.
In Vancouver.
Yeah. Cool. So now you finish up at MIT, you have an opportunity for this MD program at USC, but you, was that prior?
Yeah, that was prior. That was when I was in high school. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. So what do you do after you finish at MIT? What happens next?
Oh gosh. So I started working in the .com industry. Mm-hmm. So I was working as an interactive programmer, at a web company that was, kind of in charge of doing, rebranding for M&As, so mergers and acquisitions. So when a lot of these startups come up in Boston, New York area, you know, there are tons of other companies that have either the same or very similar ideas. Mm-hmm. So they came to our company to help ideate on different logos, mottos, mission statements, but also, you know, connect with other companies that would do like mergers or acquisitions and how to rebrand. You know, like we had this joke. It's like, okay, if you take your favorite color and your favorite animal, put them together, that's your startup company's name. And we saw so many, you know, iterations of that, like purple rhino or something, or
you know,
green lizard. And it's like, well, okay, cool. I see the pattern.
Well, that's like all those games you play as a kid where it's like, they say like, all right, your superhero name is like, you know, your middle name and the first street you remember growing up on or something like that. Yeah. That's so funny.
So, so that company, the headquarters was in New York. So it was located south of Houston, I believe on Broadway. And so when 9/11 happened, basically shut down. 9/11, that was a strange day. I was in Boston that day, and I remember my roommate just crying all morning. She spent a lot of time in New York and was just like, what's going on? It's like something happened with one of the, you know, planes and towers and something. Like they don't have a lot of information. It's like, huh, that's weird. Well, okay, I'm gonna go to work and see what happens. Went to work and everyone was, you know, just surrounded around the TV in the conference room. And, you know, the phones weren't working, cell phones were all busy, you know, busy signals. That was a weird time. Some of our executives actually took the train from New York that morning and didn't know what happened until they got into Boston for meetings.
It's interesting that period of time. I mean, it's interesting you bring that up, like that particular moment in time was sort of right on the cusp of, you know, the internet becoming more prolific. Like there was still so many analog technologies that we were engaging with on a daily basis, and the ubiquity of, you know, your smartphone or whatever, like that didn't exist. And so information traveled fast, but not nearly as fast as it does today. You know, so it's there. I was with my wife. We had just gotten married. We were on our honeymoon, and we were in the Orkney Islands in like north of Scotland. And we were driving in a car. We had a rental car where at some point they had had to change the battery, so the radio code didn't work. No, it was like locked out. And so we couldn't even listen to the radio. And we'd been driving all day in this totally barren wasteland. It was beautiful, you know. And we got to this place we were going to stay at, and we knocked on the door. It was a bed and breakfast. And the proprietor came out and he says, "Oh, hello." And he's like, "Are you American?" And we're like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I'm so sorry." And I was like, "Yeah, we're sorry too. Like, you know, like, what do you mean?" And then he told us, and we were like, "What?" It was just so crazy. But we were in that same boat, like totally out of the loop. I kind of feel like, not to get off track, but it's sort of interesting. Like, I don't know if you would agree, but I sort of feel like that event is when, at least in my mind, that's when the United States started to go crazy. And I think we've been going crazy ever since. And crazier and crazier as the last few years.
I definitely miss the times. Yeah, I definitely miss the times when we could, you know, meet friends at the gate of, you know, of their flight, as opposed to waiting in like the near check-in counters and stuff. So
yeah, not having to take our shoes off. Although in some airports you don't have to do that anymore, I've discovered. But
yeah.
So you're working there, and 9/11 happens, and their business kind of gets slows down some. Is that mm-hmm. when you leave?
Yeah. So my boyfriend at the time got a job at Bungie. We moved out to Seattle. I was out there for about 6 months. I had an internship at a games company. It was a really short internship. I think it was like a month or something. It was literally something to get me out of the house and, you know, doing something productive. And then I was like, maybe it's time to get an art degree that I've always been promising myself to do. So I applied to a whole bunch of MFA programs. So covering like fashion, illustration, watercolor, animation.
Cool, the broad spectrum approach.
Yeah. Because I didn't know, like, you know, if any of my skills or classes from undergrad would translate. I did take some cross-registration program classes with Massachusetts College of Art. You know, because there's so many colleges in the Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, Alston mm-hmm. area, that it's really easy to be able to cross register with different colleges and universities in the area if your home college does not offer those classes. So, you know, MIT being very engineering and STEM focused, not a lot of art classes were available. So I was able to take illustration and watercolor over at Massachusetts College of Art as a cross-registration.
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, when applying to MFA programs, I wasn't sure what would translate, carry over, you know, be seen as like, oh yeah, that's a legit, you know, course
credit. Did you feel like in applying, did you feel like for yourself, like really open-ended, or did you have like something, did you have your sights on anything in particular, or were you really just like?
Well, I think it was more about location. I applied to RISD, Pratt, University of Chicago, the Art Institute of Chicago School, Academy of Art. Back then it was Academy of Art College. A couple places in LA. So it was like, okay, I wanted to be in a major metropolitan area, number mm-hmm. one. Number two, the closer to film or games, the better. So I was mostly looking at East Coast and California for MFA programs. And then I ended up going to Academy of Art College. This was when they were starting to get their accreditation to become a university. So I guess now it's Academy of Art University.
Right.
because I didn't have a bachelor's in fine arts, I had to do kind of like this entry course over the summer of, I think 2002. And so
was it like a foundation style class or something?
Yeah, it was, I forget the name. I think it was similar to like life drawing or illustration 101. They just wanted to make sure that I could draw.
Yeah.
And I understood the foundations, and that's totally cool. And then, started my master's in fine arts that fall, and then got an internship at Pixar the following summer, so summer of 2003. And then I was like, wow, tuition is really expensive. I think at that point I was paying more in tuition than I had for undergrad at MIT. And I was like, I'm starting to learn a lot from not only my coworkers, but also a lot of online tutorials. Like YouTube was starting to take off in terms of tutorials. And there were just more opportunities and outlets for, you know, communities to gather and be like, hey, I'm stuck with this. Can someone help me troubleshoot? And I'm an art school dropout.
That's actually really cool though, because I think that that's a really, like, you're talking about, you know, the emergence of all of these resources, and it's, you're in a place where you're starting to focus in on something. It's less theoretical than what you talked about with regards to your undergrad. It's becoming more specified, and you see avenues to be more autodidactic and engage with the larger community and just do it on your own. I mean, I think that is so awesome. That's like such a great, like, I mean, not to be too corny, but it's like such a 21st century approach to sort of thinking about, like, well, how can I get to the point where I can do the things I want to do? And that foundation, I would think, from MIT is just so solid. Like, I mean, you've got like this really strong base from which to sort of explore all these other tendrils, you know?
It's funny because with MIT, I never think about like, oh, wow, this class changed my life. And I mean, basically all of the classes changed my life, right? But it's more of the approach to problem solving and thinking and troubleshooting and working as a team to be able to figure out, okay, I can't do this on my own, right? Like, yes, you can achieve and get a degree on your own, but really the whole process of like, you know, working on a group project and working across time zones, and, you know, everyone has a great story to tell, and someone has, you know, different experiences than you and might have already figured out the problem that you're tackling right now, is what I think is like the heart of what I've learned from MIT. So I found that very helpful in like, oh, okay, well, I could sit here alone and try to figure it out, but there's got to be someone else out there that's figured it out, has done it better, more efficient. I don't know, something that's
You know, it's interesting you say that though, because like I didn't go to MIT, so I don't know like what that sort of course structure is like and how the sort of classes operate. But you just, in your description anyway, you talk about it being kind of more theoretical, but that there were these sort of team oriented projects and whatnot, but it becomes so, that sounds so relevant, to working in a place like Pixar or in a place like ILM, where like that creative problem solving, a big team oriented project, figuring out like, oh, I'm not sure how are we going to do this, and having all these different kind of disciplines coming together where, a whole bunch of different solutions can be proposed, and you learn so much from each other that way too.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, even now I still feel like I'm learning a lot. Learned so much at Google, and I've only been at Google for, well, approaching 4 years. So 3.5 years now. But yeah, like every person I meet has a different experience, can, you know, give me different advice, and you know, it's awesome.
That's cool. That's so exciting. So you drop out of art school, but you had an internship at Pixar, and did that, like, was that a part of like an academic internship or just something?
No. So, I knew that I wanted to work in film or games at that point. And I remember watching all of the Pixar shorts and just waiting with like great anticipation for each next movie to come out. And I started, you know, reading the credits, and it's like, wow, what does that department do? What does that department do? They're over in East Bay. Maybe I should just see what positions they have open. And they have a separate section, at least back then, mm-hmm. a separate section on their webpage for internships. I was like, well, it's free to apply. Apply. And I think that kind of started the whole career mobility for me.
What did you do as an intern when you got there? What was the gig that you landed when?
So I was one of four technical director interns. So the four of us, we got to choose which movie we worked on. So two picked Incredibles, one picked Ratatouille, and I was on Cars. And then, our intern manager was like, okay, well, what do you want to do? It's like, shoot, I feel like this is a pop quiz. I should probably look at the credits again to see what the departments do and look them up and everything. I was like, well, I actually don't know. Like, what are the options? It's like, you're going to do lighting and shading. I was like, why do you need to light something? Why do you need to shade something? Doesn't that automatically happen? It's like, all right, yeah, you're going to learn a lot.
That's so cool. So you really didn't even have like a thought about like what that meant when they described it to you. You were just,
yeah,
that's so interesting.
Piece it together with the, you know, computer graphics class that I had taken, I think, let's see, so 2003, so that would have been like 3 years prior. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, okay, so all the, you know, ray casting and ray marching and the shaders do this versus like putting texture maps, you know, do this. It's like, okay, gotcha, all right, now it's a little bit more, you know, connected in my mind, like what the theory and the math from, you know, undergrad meant in production and production terminology.
That's like weirdly too, like, I mean, you know, whatever people think of, you know, their favorite Pixar movies. Like I watched that one a ton when my kid was little, cause he loved Cars, anything Cars, not Cars the movie, but just Cars in general, total car obsessed little boy. But, one of the things I think that's really interesting actually about that film is it was one of the first films that Pixar did, if memory serves, that was, it had a much more photorealistic way of dealing with light, in that all the hard metallic surfaces and glass and a lot of the stuff happening at night. So kind of an exciting one to be on, I would think.
Yeah. And it was just such a different movie, because at that point, you know, two of the interns were on Incredibles. So that was like humanoid, human figure articulation, rigging, skin, hair, all the way to Ratatouille, you know, animal fur, quadruped to biped movement, and then Cars in the middle, which was like, okay, we gotta make these cars emote. How do we do that?
Yeah.
But have it look good too. So, yeah.
So was it just like a 4 or 5 month internship, or?
Yeah, it was just for the summer. And then I went back to grad school, and then started applying for full-time jobs, and then started at ILM October 2003. And then it got to be too much to do grad school and working full-time. So yeah.
So you applied
out of grad school.
Did you know people at ILM from your time at Pixar, or was it like kind of a cold, like just cold application?
That was another cold application. Yeah. That's why I, you know, for for people who are looking for jobs, I always encourage people to just apply, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even if they don't fulfill all of the minimum qualifications or, you know.
Yeah, you can't win if you don't play, right?
You gotta just like put yourself out there and not wait to be discovered.
Now, I'm curious, 2003, I really should take notes when I do these interviews with people because I should know this by now after 60 some odd interviews, but
no worries.
I left ILM in 1999 and they were still in San Rafael. In 2003, mm-hmm. they were in the Presidio, right?
No, not yet. Oh, so okay. Presidio move was over the course of two quarters in 2005.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I gotta remember that.
2005. Yeah. Almost so, the 20th anniversary of the move.
So did you, when you started, were you in C building?
Oh gosh. So I started off in render support. So I was actually
in the trailer.
Double-wide trailer. Yeah. So we were near C building and we did use the restrooms in C building, but
yes,
yeah, no, we were pretty close to Dagobah.
Yeah, I remember the trailer. The trailer so culture so yeah. Well. So render support, were you on day shift, night shift, swing shift?
So I started off on I think day shift for like 2 weeks and then moved to swing shift for like a couple months and then graveyard for yeah. several months.
How did you fare on graveyard? There's some quite a few fascinating tales of graveyard.
Oh gosh. So graveyard was interesting. So at that time it was, I think, winter time ish. So yeah, lots of rain, lots of animals and critters just yep. building their nests and habitats. And I remember someone joined render support and we heard some scratching underneath one of our tabs, which is like a metal filing cabinet that you can use as like a cushion seat next to someone's desk. We heard some scratching. It's like, oh gosh, is that in the filing cabinet or is it below or is it above? Like, what is going on? So we open up all the drawers. Nothing's happening. Okay, great. We move the tab over. There's a hole in the floor of the trailer.
Oh my God.
Where like a family of raccoons are kind of like building up their nest. And I remember, like, we move the tab over, we see the hole, the raccoons look up at us, they're just like, what?
What?
Like, so sorry. We move the tab back. It's like, well, curiosity, yep, we know exactly what's going on.
Is so awesome. That's
and
so
every
funny.
Once in a while, we would hear, like, squirrels jump from the really big tree onto the tin roof. Over to C building. So we would hear a thump and then like little pitter patter. And
tell
then
you, there's a Pixar movie in there somewhere.
I yeah. It's like, maybe they're trying to watch cable TV.
Yeah.
That's totally. Where the satellite dish was. It's like, maybe. All right.
That's so funny. So I'm just sort of curious, are you kind of a night owl type person? Was it okay for you working at night or was that really hard?
So, at that time, it was okay. Like for swing shift, that was probably the worst shift for me because I couldn't either get my stuff done during the day, like, you know, doctor's appointments or, you know, grocery shopping, cooking, what have you, because swing shift started at 2.
Right.
And goes until 10. And when you get out, like everything's closed. So at least with graveyard, we knew everything was closed. So, you know, order your dinner.
Just work. Yep.
Just work. Hang out with security guards.
yep.
Play Halo to pass some time. So yeah, like graveyard was, you know, as workable as day shift. I think swing shift was the you're getting the worst of both shifts.
Now doing render support, like, were you then like on a sort of technical director trajectory in terms of like a full-time, well, not, I mean, obviously that was a full-time job, but in terms of a, you know, a show specific kind of assignment?
Yeah. So at least with render support, we definitely got to chat and talk and troubleshoot with a lot of the daytime TDs. So, you know, with render support, we would watch all the shots and make sure that they would go through, well enough for dailies to happen. And yeah, you know, this was a lot of kind of like the customer support and, like human touch to it. Cause it's like, yeah, your shot's broken. Okay. You're not going to hang up on a TD that needs that shot run for dailies the next day. So you could be on the phone for, you know, an hour trying to troubleshoot because yeah, we didn't have work from home setups mm-hmm. back then. Nor could you like really easily remote check in, you know, any of your shots or work. Sure. So it was literally troubleshooting over the phone. And if super, super desperate, you know, like ask the TD to come in, but you have to exhaust all of the troubleshooting possibilities before asking them
it's
to
kind
come
of interesting.
In.
It's true though. Like that's there's a soft skills piece to that, like being able to kind of, engage and interact, especially via telephone about mm-hmm. something that is, you know, a technical problem with, yeah, with something that's an image based.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, like, what do you see on frame 35? It's like,
nothing.
There's a black tile over in the lower quadrant.
Right.
The Huffman encoding didn't pass. And, I've tried rerunning the frame. Can't do it. I don't have permissions to, you know, look at this or do that. So, yeah.
So were you in, were you assigned specific shows at that time too?
So with render support, there were, I would say like 4 or 5 people per shift. And so we would overlap. So depending on the shot load per show, we would split it up. So, one of the bigger shows when I was in render support was EP3, Star Wars Episode 3. Mm-hmm. I think it had like 2,200 shots or 2,500 shots, and they ranged all from, you know, model, texture, creature dev, lighting, comp, TD, just all sorts. So, you know, with like hundreds of shots to run through, sometimes we would split them up. So, you know, by sequence order. So someone would take, you know, 2 or 3 sequences, someone else would take 2 or 3 sequences so we could cover such a large show.
I don't know if you would agree with me, but I mean, I kind of think that those types of jobs, like, which I don't know how common they are now with, like you said, with being able to remote in and like, and work from home kind of setups too. Like, but I do think that those render support and what we used to, they probably didn't do tape IO then, did they still?
I actually started off in tape IO. So
but
I
even
had
that, like
the tapes in Hero Robot.
I think there's something about like that, the engagement with the pipeline structure, the production structure at that really granular level that I think provides a level of insight into the totality of the process of, you know, making a project like that, a big scale project that you only see from that level. I think there's something really profound about having that window of time to garner that experience.
Yeah.
I think. I don't know. That's cool. So do you, you do Graveyard for a while, and then did they make you commit to like 6 months or a year of that before?
No, I think it was more of like what shows that are upcoming that have room for ATDs. So my first ATD show, oh geez, if I remember correctly, was it, I think it was Star Wars. Yeah. Star Wars EP3. But my first movie credit was Lemony Snicket.
Okay.
Based on the number of hours that I was doing render support for them.
Right.
And I moved to ATD for Star Wars Episode 3 and then stayed ATD for a while through Evan Almighty. So that covers Star Wars Ep 3, Chicken Little 3D, Pirates 2, and Evan Almighty.
Mm-hmm.
And then, started doing some lighting and VFX for, I did some snow effects for Lions for Lambs, some for Evan Almighty, some lighting work.
I'm curious, like, as you get into doing like shot work and having those opportunities, are you enjoying it?
It was definitely a different mentality shift. Like, it was definitely a different approach because, like, at that point I had been, you know, either in render support or ATD where it's like, okay, incoming support questions or troubleshooting is, you know, kind of one way, right? Like, you mm-hmm. don't really have an opportunity in render support to say like, well, someone else fix this problem. It really lands on you to fix the problem. Whereas, you know, doing shot work, it's like, okay, I'm going to try this, but, you know, I need this for dailies or afternoon lays for review for this. And, you know, I need to make this shot work because other people in the pipeline are dependent, right?
Right,
I got the input from another department, but, you know, maybe comp is waiting, maybe effects is waiting. So it was a mentality shift.
Mm-hmm.
And also just like a working approach shift from ATD to doing shot work. So it was more time-based. It was just like, hey, the deadline is due. You know, we need to send the reels out by this time on this day. It's like, do whatever you need to do to get it done. Because
well, it's interesting.
It's never late.
I guess, yeah, the reason I sort of ask, I guess, is that, you know, I think as, you know, computer graphics by that point is like firmly in charge of like the future of visual effects, you know, like everything is gone mostly digital. It's interesting to see a little bit of things, analog things coming back a touch here and there, although digitally shot and augmented for sure. But
yeah.
As the shot counts increase and the demands on the facility increase and the crews get larger, there is, I think, a degree to which the pressure on the individual artist and the ability to feel like you have opportunities to be really creative. Do you feel like those, do you feel like that was always sustained, or do you feel like that ever was compressed any, or is that hard to say?
I think, well, at least from my experience at ILM, it's hard to say because number one, I worked at ILM as an artist, like a digital artist, so long ago that I don't know if, like, my experience or, you know, my opinion is relevant for this world of work, right? But I mean,
it's relevant if it's your opinion. It's like,
well, just in the approach to scalability and how can you sustain a technology stack and a business to be able to scale, mm-hmm. I think is like the larger question. There are opportunities to be able to fix and be creative and, you know, troubleshoot in interesting ways. I don't know if we're reaching a plateau in that area because there are so many, you know, studios and pipelines that are getting standardized and doing the same thing, that when you join as a digital artist, it's not so much about the artistry, it's about getting those shots done by a certain date. So,
well, and I suppose you could define creativity in different ways too.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's like, you know, not to be so narrow. I was curious just for you when you talked about, you know, having, you know, this kind of, you know, practical foundation, you know, from your parents and sort of wanting you to do this sort of specific kind of thing. And then your desire to do something creative, to do something art related. Like if it felt like once you got into doing that to some degree, if it was fulfilling, I guess is sort of what I was wondering.
Oh, I see. Yes, it was fulfilling because I definitely loved seeing my name in the credits.
Yeah, that's cool, right?
So something like that really kind of codifies, like, hey, you were part of this huge creative endeavor, right? Like, and you know, that was certainly satisfying. And you know, having an IMDb page is cool.
You probably make a lot of friends too, right? In the time that you're there, I assume, right?
Yeah. So especially with ILM, yeah, you know, we went through some crunch times because, you know, ILM is never late in delivering shots. So, yeah, had a lot of late nights and, you know, just like, oh, sitting at the computer, like, what is going on? Troubleshooting, ready to just like throw your computer out the window.
So you're there and you said at the beginning, but you were there till what year for the first stint? 2008. Yeah. So you made the move over to the Presidio and were working there for a while. And then at what point do you decide to leave?
So I was working on the HDR IBL pipeline. So high dynamic range and image based lighting.
So you'd moved into another area.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of moved around in, you know, ILM my first time. Then I was like, well, I kind of want to work on shots again. So, I actually moved over to California Academy of Sciences in the planetarium department.
Oh, cool.
To work on the first digital planetarium show that they had called Fragile Planet. So that was released in 2000.
How did that opportunity come up? Was that somebody you knew was doing that?
Oh, gosh.
Did you read about it? I mean, that's really cool. That's a really interesting transition to go do something like that.
Yeah, I think someone either posted it up on the old ILM alumni webpage or something. Because there were some ILM alumni there.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I kind of wouldn't mind working on a planetarium show. Like, that's
that's cool.
Old school, you know, old.
Was it like a dome projection?
It was the dome projection. Yeah. So
for like the digital system or something.
So instead of using the star gun where it's like all the cameras are in the center of the dome projecting out. This is a new half dome system where it's the projectors on the side projecting
across.
Yeah.
Cool. How fun.
Yeah. So, this was when California Academy of Sciences was moving back into the Golden Gate Park area. They were housed in like a small SOMA building while it was getting retrofitted and renovated. And they were just like, yeah, we should switch over from like the star projector gun, you know, projecting outwards onto the dome and switch over to projecting cross dome. It's like, this is going to be interesting. And so, you know, like my work on Chicken Little 3D to help make that film stereo definitely helped with just kind of understanding how multi-camera projections work for a single movie, but it's not on like a classic, you know, 16:9 format. It's 180 degrees and it was tilted. So the dome is tilted so that you can have stadium seating and have really good visibility.
And it must've been a pretty small, much smaller team. Yeah. Doing that?
Much smaller. Yeah. So it was probably 7 people total.
Because that gives, like, working with a small team like that, like, you are like a key player in all the decision making that's going on, which has got to be kind of exciting too.
And it was like 7 people between, you know, the director, the executive producer, comp, two or three TDs, and the editor. Yeah.
That's cool. I mean, that's a really fun, like, unique kind of opportunity. And how long did that go for?
So I was at California Academy of Sciences for about a year, a little less than a year. And then I moved over to freelancing. So yeah, worked at a whole bunch of small boutique VFX houses.
Were they mostly all in the Bay Area?
Let's see. So I worked at Polygon Visual Effects, which was run by Hans Ulig in San Rafael. And then Cafe Effects, which is was down in Santa Maria, California. And then I went back to Polygon for a short stint and then went to Spy Post for a month. That was probably my shortest gig. And then moved over to Image Movers Digital. And then, my last film job.
Yeah. And IMD, were you there till it closed?
Yeah. So yeah. I actually joined after the announcement that they would be closing.
Oh.
So yeah,
why not?
Meet up and work with like a whole bunch of friends from ILM, my first stint there. So yeah, it was a little bit like coming home.
So after your last film job, is that what did you do after that? Did you go, you've only been at Google for a little while. So
yeah. So I went over to Microsoft to work on Xbox. So initially I started off working at 343 Industries on Halo 4.
That's cool. So you got to scratch the game itch too.
Yep.
That's awesome.
I was like, this is what I've been waiting for. I've been waiting to work on not only my favorite game franchise at the time, because we were playing Halo and all of the new releases of Halo, like in Graveyard Shift and Swing Shift. And yeah, when things got, you know, crunchy at, you know, for shots at ILM. So yeah, I was just like, oh my goodness, I'm finally here.
And were the jobs working in games, like transitioning, was it a fairly smooth transition from working in, because I've heard different things from different people, like, because there's the schedule usually isn't the same. It's much more luxurious.
Correct. Yeah. So I think it depends on the person's experience. Like for me, I think it was fine because I went over to becoming a tech artist for lighting. And so that meant that, you know, I was scripting and writing up tools. I'm like, oh, this is totally like what ATDs did, you know, like building up a pipeline, scripting and troubleshooting and just kind of building out a sustainable pipeline so that it can be reused over and over again, whether you're, you know, like a longtime lighting artist or a cinematics artist or a vignette, you know, lighting artist, like someone should be able to jump in and use the tool. It's like, okay, great. I know this space. Cool. I think for people who haven't used a game engine before, it's quite different because you get the results immediately, except for some parts.
I bet that's changing a lot now too, though, in people working in effects, because there's so much now, you know, game real-time rendering, you know, tools being used in effects.
Yeah.
I mean, they're now kind of one and the same. Finally, it's sort of like the holy grail of computer graphics for a long time was to get to that point of some kind of real-time ray tracing, you know, like having something like that.
And I distinctly remember when I was at IMD and I said, hey, I got a job at Microsoft working on games. Someone asked me, like, why do you want to work in games? They look terrible and, you know, production times are really long. And it's like, my goal has always been to have art and engineering together in my career. So whether that means that I'm on the engineering, programming, scripting side of things or production and, you know, running shots type of thing, I'm okay with not having any more, you know, film credits, but I always wanted to have this pairing of visualization for the engineering work that you do. And I always thought, like, well, games run in real time. Why can't movies do that too? And so I felt like at that point, it was very much a tipping point in 2010 for me, because it was like, okay, I've gotten like a good breadth of experience in film, like pre-rendered media. Mm-hmm. Like now I should see what the real-time portion looks like and how can we accelerate any of the visualizations for film so that it can be closer to what we expect to see. Like, can we get a tool that is what you see is what you get, WYSIWYG, into pipelines on either end? And I still believe that we can learn from all sorts of different portions of the industries, right? So it's not like one industry should poo-poo the other and, you know, like, or like say, oh, this is the only industry that I want to work in, right?
Well, like, and I think now it's so obvious, like that it's like that that's ludicrous, you know, like there's so much runway and you can see so far now, like into this potential future of the sort of convergence of all these tool sets. Like there's going to be some pretty amazing, I mean, already there are, but I think there are so many amazing things to come through the sort of, I hate this term, but through the sort of synergy of all those things coming together, you know. But I have to ask, I totally was thinking, you mentioned you'd gotten your movie credits and stuff. What did your parents think of your career? Like, were they digging it when you were started working on movies or? Did you ever get any feedback from them?
Yeah, I think they were happy that I started working in movies, but they also wanted to make sure that I was making enough money to live in the Bay Area, like, comfortably.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it'd be hard to do that, maybe in some cases, even as a doctor.
Yeah, it's like, cool, you're making movies. Great to see that these movies are delightful and thought-provoking and maybe just, like, silly popcorn summer movies.
They must have come out to visit you at some point, right? When you were working in ILM and stuff.
Yeah. I don't think I showed them the trailers.
This is where the raccoons live.
It's like, look, a family of raccoons. Aren't they so cute? We call them trash pandas here. Yeah. It's like, probably not.
It's so funny.
I think my parents got to see the Presidio at some point. And where was I?
I mean, it's kind of an impressive place, you know?
Yeah. I would think a Yoda statue and like the beautiful fountains and all the artwork. It's just amazing. Yeah.
I'm just always curious about that. Like, especially when parents are sort of uncertain about that trajectory. Like, I think when somebody actually starts, you know, making a living and doing that kind of work, sometimes they're like, oh, this is pretty cool. How weird.
Yeah.
Like,
how did we spawn this child? Yourself now. Okay, great.
Yeah. So, you're working at 343 and doing stuff on games and up in Seattle again, right? Yes. And was that the last job before the current one?
Oh gosh. No. So I was at 343 as a tech artist for lighting. Then I moved over to becoming a lighting artist because we had so few lighting artists. And then helped do technical direction for the cinematics. So just being the owner of the pipeline for the cinematics pipeline. Because the old system was actually acquired from Bungie, and it was just it wasn't modern. Mm-hmm. It wasn't sustainable to have multiple people working on a given cinematic at the same time. So helped build out a system and a pipeline so that different people can work on different shots at different times and they wouldn't clobber each other's work. And then for Halo 5, I switched over to production. So I became a program manager, producer. And then, I was like, gosh, I actually kind of miss working on the assets. So I switched over to Project Spark, which is Team Dakota, still at Microsoft, but a different studio.
Yep.
Worked as a tech artist, character tech artist at Team Dakota. And then Microsoft bought acquired Minecraft. And so everyone moved over to Minecraft. And that's when I moved over to HoloLens.
I remember,
I remember my interviews for HoloLens. They were just like, we can't tell you what we're working on, but it is really, really cool. It is, it's a research project, but it's also, you know, really, really cool. It's like, okay, well, I've signed a lot of, you know, NDAs before. So it's like when someone says that it's cool and I'm talking to the heads of, you know, like the execs of that project, it's like, okay, all right, I'm on board. I want to try it, you know, like I want to try it. And so, yeah, I worked on HoloLens as a tech artist for the pipeline on the analog design side. So was working on animation exporters and audio exporters for the first HoloLens. And yeah, when the announcement came out for HoloLens, it was super, super cool because people were like, what are you working on? Like, what is Microsoft working on? It's like,
well, it's cool to get a chance to work on like on hardware, right? Like you're helping like come up with all the systemic tools for, you know, making this hardware do its thing.
Like,
So it's actually not just a hunk of plastic. Like that's really interesting. And that's a total transition where the product isn't, you know, something that's up on screen or something that you're playing with a controller. Like now there's this physical thing. I mean, that's pretty neat.
And I remember when I first got the audio exporting running and we got spatial audio running on the dev kit, I was walking around. It's like, I'm going to put a bird here. It's like, can you hear it? It's like just passing around the headphones and the dev kits. It's like, oh my gosh, it sounds like there's a bug buzzing in the lamp. Okay, move it over there. It's like, okay, moving it over there.
That's
it's
awesome.
Like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. And it's like, having just a computer running on your head and it's not, you know.
Well, that reminds me, that's like the first time I ever heard like a binaural audio recording where it was like I can't remember the artist's name. It was some woman and she did a walk through some place and like listening to it, it was different than most of the kind of things you might hear on like NPR or something where you're like, whoa, like it's a spatial experience. Like you feel like you're present in that space and it's so transportative, like as just on the aural level, like it was so cool.
And it's just amazing that we have that now in little wireless earbuds.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, you know, with head tracking and spatial, you know, audio. And it's like mind blowing how much has improved and been able to, you know, reach consumers, you know, at a consumer level, not even a prosumer level, like people can just buy it.
It's definitely wild. Like, all the things like from when, you know, probably when we were kids, like the sort of fantasy of all these technologies and how now it feels like it's getting faster and faster and faster and faster, which is cool. Yeah. I mean, I love it too. Like, so you're working on HoloLens and you're there for a time.
Yes, about like 6 months. Well, a little less than a year. And then after the announcement, it was like, okay, we're actually making a product. And yeah, the head TD was like, well, do you want to stay on for the product side? It's like, I don't know, like this research stuff is pretty cool. So I started looking around again and I switched over to NVIDIA. At NV Studios up in the Redmond, Washington area to work on a unfortunately unreleased game project that was supposed to be more of like a kind of like a research project. And it just didn't pan out. So project got canceled after a while, unfortunately, but
Well, but it's still cool sometimes.
That's what happens.
I sometimes think like my only analogous experience is I worked on I Am Legend at Sony Imageworks one year, on leave from the university where I teach. And I worked on this huge sequence that was pretty cool with all this, you know, at the time it was really innovative, like subsurface scattering stuff. And it was really fun. And then the whole sequence got cut from the movie. And I was always like, I tell my students that, and they say like, oh, that must've been so devastating. And I always think like, well, kind of, but like I did get paid and I learned a lot and it was really interesting. Like the experience, the journey was kind of still worth it, you know, even though the thing never sort of is seen by anybody. So
yeah.
That's kind of the shakes, I think, when it comes to entertainment stuff.
And that's the industry, right? It's like, I think just overall, like having shots cut or sequences cut or projects end or, you know, projects get canceled is, I don't know, kind of made me into sterner stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I don't want to have that happen more often than not, but you know, when it does happen, it's like
you roll with it.
Yeah. You can move on from it. So
yeah, totally. Totally. So after at NVIDIA, the project doesn't come out, but you're there for a time, I gather.
Yeah, for a year. Yep. Yeah. And then one of my managers from Microsoft reached out to me and was like, hey, is it possible that you could give me a recommendation for this role at Lucasfilm? I'm like, whoa, wait. Okay, now all of my worlds are colliding at this point, right? I'm like, oh, okay, who are you talking to? Who's on your interview loop? What role is it for? What group? Blah, blah, blah. And I can help write up a recommendation letter. And so I did that. You know, my former Microsoft manager gets hired at Lucasfilm, and he was like, okay, I've got the perfect role for you. Do you want to apply for it? I'm like, oh, sure. Yeah. Let's see what happens. And so it was a little bit of a back and forth because I wasn't, you know, like this was while I was still at NVIDIA and I wasn't sure whether the project was going to get funded or not, or move forward, or, you know, expand or contract. And I was like, yeah, might as well, you know, apply. And it was for a technical project manager position on ADG. So the Advanced Development Group, which is the engineering portion, like department of ILM XLab. So everything was like super new. The group was pretty small at the time, because this was back in 2016. They hadn't really announced a lot of big stuff yet, like any of the projects or collaborations and stuff. So same thing, like when I asked, like, what are the projects that are coming up? What's the timeline on this? It's like, oh, we're still thinking about a whole bunch of projects that we can't tell you about. It's like, cool. All right. Gotcha. I'm still on board. That was definitely like coming home. So, you know, Lucasfilm, ILM is...
And that X Lab,
like home for me. Yeah.
You were working back out of the Presidio again then, right?
Yeah. So it's like, oh yeah, I know how to get from like this building's floor to this building's floor, how to get to the cafeteria and all this stuff. It was like, right.
Well, and a lot of those like X Lab projects, at least the ones that they've made public, like they're, you know, sort of an interesting mix of, you know, the sort of VR and, you know, traditional production, real-time rendered stuff. Yeah. And it's kind of a fun, I would think, sort of centered, like I could say, use that word again. I'm going to have to like punish myself for saying it twice,
no worries.
But it, like, it's all kind of coming together. Like you're sort of using all of those things in the same way and you're back in the same engaging with a lot of the same intellectual property, I guess.
Yeah. And it was so lovely to, you know, go back to Lucasfilm, because, you know, some of my friends and old coworkers from my first stint are still there, you know. Like, oh my goodness, they sent me a message, they sent me a ping. Oh my goodness, it's so good to hear from you. And, you know, to get my old login back, that was cool. It's like, oh, that was that script that I wrote back in 2004 to do this and that. Oh gosh, like I'm so ashamed at the quality of that code. Sorry, so anyone who had to maintain it in the last like 10 years.
That's so good.
But yeah, our first project, well, my first project on Lucasfilm ADG was the Magic Leap collaboration. So actually worked very closely with Magic Leap on kind of like the tabletop demo. So I think it's on YouTube now, where it's like C-3PO and R2-D2 are walking around a projected version of a village. It's like they're walking around it. You can look at C-3PO and R2-D2 independently of the tabletop miniatures. So that was one of the first projects, was to engage a little bit more deeply with Magic Leap. And then they got off and running and doing their thing. And then I switched over to Live CG X, which culminated in augmented reality fashion show at London Fashion Week in 2018. So that
How cool.
Yeah. So that was February 2018, working.
I mean, with that must have been kind of fun, because that's like, that's funny. That's like one of the first things you mentioned when you talked about like looking at graduate schools for art, like you mentioned fashion. And so it's like you get an opportunity to do that too. That's great.
Yeah. So I feel really, really fortunate that, you know, with Lucasfilm, we were able to do something kind of groundbreaking like this. Like, how can we take some of the virtual production, the real-time rendering, and, you know, the LED wall setup, but have it be really accessible to people who can't or won't wear a headset to do, you know, VR or AR using, you know, either Magic Leap, HoloLens, Oculus.
I'm kind of curious, like, this might be kind of an ignorant question, and I don't know if, but it seems like, did the sort of AR, VR stuff that was happening in XLab lead to, or is it connected to the kind of things that start happening in virtual production? Because it's sort of like they're sort of inside out versions of each other, right? In a strange way. Or were they sort of simultaneously being developed for different use cases? I don't know if you know, but
for different use cases. We had seen on the XLab ADG side, we had seen what, you know, virtual production shots were happening in sequences on
so that was already ILM going on.
Side. Okay. So it was just like, oh, could we use like a smaller scale of the, you know, LED wall to do the fashion show? And we actually got to work really closely with the ILM stage in London in the Cheswick studios. And it's like, okay, what if we get someone who's doing mocap and we have an LED wall projecting out some of these visualizations? Would that work? And can we do it in a government building in London? All right, let's see if this can happen.
That sounds so fun. What a great set of challenges.
Yeah, so, gosh, this was right when Kinect 2 was going out of production. So Microsoft was like, nope, we're not going to buy, we're not going to manufacture any more Kinects. And we were thinking, oh no, like all of our depth maps in real time are acquired through a series of overlapping, you know, field of views of a whole bunch of Kinect cameras. Oh no, what if we need parts? What if they don't work? What if, you know, the power supply blows? We need to buy like a whole bunch of Kinects before they're just not available at all. So we did that. Yeah, we were out in London for about 3 weeks to do like tests and setup and just figuring out rentals and, you know, for the LED wall panels and mocap actor hiring and, you know, rehearsals. So,
you know, have you ever, I'm just so, it's interesting, like the kinds of things that you've been involved in and the way in which, you know, your career sounds like it really transitioned into this thing that's so much more like your undergraduate experience, where there's so much research based stuff that you're engaged with, like at the onset of all these kind of emerging kind of concepts and ideas around using tools in some unique ways. Have you ever thought about, or do you ever make like, or have time, I guess that's the thing, to make work of your own? Like, I mean, it seems like the, like, one of the things I've always said, so I worked in New York for a while, working with some like, you know, fine artists, right? Like who had big museum shows and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've always been sort of fascinated that I don't know that I've ever seen like a high sort of high level artist working with digital technologies in a like really profound and sort of almost like research-based way and showing work in like, you know, blue chip galleries and big museums. Like there's a couple, but not that many. And it's like, it's interesting, like your interest in both worlds. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about that at all?
I have, but I've been kind of busy in the last 5 years.
Well, yeah, time is the
hard thing to find. When I was at NVIDIA, I started working on my master's degree at Harvard. And so all throughout, you know, my second time at Lucasfilm and, you know, part of my time at Google was working on this master's degree in my not so copious spare time.
And was it a computer science master's?
So it was a master's in liberal arts focusing on management.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Cool. So it's kind of like, got the engineering degree, dropped out of art school, finished up my management degree. Now suddenly I have a bit more free time, but I'm still volunteering with a lot of initiatives and groups. So yeah, it'll still be busy.
Yeah, cool. I mean, that's so neat. I mean, it's interesting you went back and you did get your master's. And I was like working in management. Is that something that's part of how you're working now?
So not particularly. Like when I left Lucasfilm, it was, I started off helping out on the engineering side for Mandalorian. So virtual production, Mandalorian season one. Mm-hmm. Then when I moved over to Google at the end of 2018, it's like, well, this is research again. And I went back to tech art and I wasn't sure if I wanted to do people management. So stayed on the IC track. I'm still on IC, which is an individual contributor. With Google, it's actually a separate job ladder. So you can stay in IC in your job area for a while, or you can do people management with the IC component being in that same job ladder, but it's a different track until you get to like director level, mm-hmm. which will be a long time for me.
Well, it's kind of a different set of skills too, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. like you're really bringing a whole nother side of you to bear if you're mm-hmm. taking on that kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And so I do see a lot of great examples of, you know, inspirational managers and, you know, the people management skills that are needed for like such a big tech company. Mm-hmm.
Well, especially now too. I mean, you've had so many different experiences in your career so far. Like, I mean, you've probably seen examples of great management and probably like pretty shitty management too, right? Where it's like you sort of see both.
Are we allowed to swear?
Sure. And when you sort of see like, you see both and you sort of see like, well, that's not very effective, you know? Yep. Like that's not going to get like people to like play ball and like, you know, work mm-hmm. together. Like that doesn't engender a sense of camaraderie or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think that's really an invaluable thing that you learn. Yeah. Just over time too.
Yeah.
Definitely. Some people, I guess, are just good at it because they're magical humans. But, you know, some people, you learn it as you go, I think.
Yeah.
That's cool. I think I've... Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so you're at Google now and you're having a good time and enjoying your gig. And do you have any, are there things that you think about down the road? Like if an opportunity came up that you really would love to do that you haven't done yet?
Oh, geez. I think even in my short time at Google so far that, you know, I've been fortunate to see so many different incarnations of what a project or product area or group can go through in a big tech company. So I've seen, you know, my research group that I started off with initially, I've seen it get reorged. I've seen it, you know, I've seen that reorg not go so great. I've seen the project ending. I've seen funding not come through. I've seen funding come through like a windfall. Seen people leave, seen people join. I've done a whole different job category. So I started off in the UX ladder, switched over to technical program management. I've been on both the product, you know, production area where it's like, okay, we have a deadline, we got to release here, all the way to blue sky thinking. If we had, let's say, $10 million, what would we do? It's like, ooh, I've got ideas, you know? So that entire spectrum, even in, you know, three and a half years at Google, I've seen all of it. And so it's a lot.
That's cool though. I mean, it definitely like, I mean, you know, seeing all that and having that consciousness of all of it, it makes it, you know, down the road, like as things evolve and develop organically, like, you know, there could be pathways to open up where it sort of, as you've described your whole trajectory, it's been kind of like, you know, not like a laser beam, like going in one direction, but just kind of like, oh, I'll try this and I'll try that. Like, and it's been like a really great, it sounds like for you, it's worked out really well.
I think so.
Yeah, so far, just having that approach, like being open like that, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, like maybe partway through my career trajectory, it was like a red flag to have been at so many different places in, you know, in sequence. And it's like, I'm sorry, that's how film is. Like if you're not on staff, you're going to be freelance. You're going to be 1 month here or a year there or 6 months there.
Well, I sometimes think too, like, I mean, you mentioned earlier, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way. I just think in terms of myself, and maybe this is, you could relate to this too. Like, you know, I was at ILM right out of college and I loved it. And it was the best, like, you know, post-secondary education I could ever have wanted, you know, and it changed who I am. It changed my brain. It made me look at, you know, problem solving and working with others in a totally different way. But I look at some of my friends who started at the same time as I did, who are still there. And I think, and they've done amazing things and have had an amazing, like super long career at one company, which is cool. But I also know, like, I couldn't have done that. No way. Like I had to go do other stuff. Like there were too many other, like, you know, ghosts in the attic that I had to, like, you know, shine a light on or something.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good point. Yeah. I always thought like, oh, maybe I should have just stayed at one job and not hopped around so much, but I've met so many different people. I mean, I think I did a recent count of how many jobs I've gotten paid for, like how many companies, and it's like around 20.
I mean, so I think it makes it like, I would think it just makes your experience and what you bring to bear on whatever project you're working on, like it's so much richer in a way. Like there's such a panoply or diversity of perspectives that you bring to bear, you know?
Well, definitely going to GDC and SIGGRAPH and basically any other industry conference, like even with GDC the last couple times, it's like, I'm not even going to sign up for any sessions. And people are like, why not? It's like, because I will get stopped outside of the conference hall because people want to catch up and chat. It's like, oh yeah, because you've worked at like
all these
five
places,
different game companies and 15 different, you know, film companies, it's like, all right, cool, see you later for lunch. It's like, yeah, I mean, even this happened for GDC last time, like the last time I was in San Francisco 2 months ago or so, I was literally driving around and I pulled over to, you know, check my phone, and then someone knocked on my window. It's like, Maggie? It's like, oh my goodness. Like, I didn't even buy a pass. I'm not even supposed to be in the area and someone's knocking on my car
That's
window.
That's awesome.
You know, yeah, just say hi.
You can't escape it. You've done it to yourself.
It's fun. You know, like I always say that, you know, for work stuff, I'm an extrovert. Like I want to meet people and meet up with people and hang out, and I get energy from that. So I'm really looking forward to SIGGRAPH and, you know, conferences and just meeting up with people in person. And, you know, when I'm off work, I'm an introvert, right? So it's like, oh, I can actually spend some time on, you know, homework, you know, semester, or, you know, doing this and doing that. So,
well, you got to have your downtime to recharge too.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Just that balance.
Maggie O, it has been totally inspiring and so much fun to talk to you. Like I feel like if we had met and been at ILM at the same time, we would have been friends.
Oh,
it's so awesome to talk to you. And if I see you at SIGGRAPH or something, I'm buying you a beer.
Oh, yay.
But thanks so much for so much of your time. It's really cool to get to know you and
absolutely.
To chat with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity. And have a great rest of your weekend.
You too.